Fellow risk takers, this is your worst podcast host, Andrew Stotz from A. Stotz Academy, continuing my discussion with Larry Swedrow, who for three decades was the head of research at Buckingham Wealth Partners. You can learn more about his story at episode 645. Now, Larry stands out because he bridges both the academic research world and practical investing. Today, we're diving into a chapter from his recent book, Enrich Your Future, The Keys to Successful Investing, and that is chapter 34. Bear markets, a necessary evil. And just to highlight, Larry just wrote on his Substack. If you're not subscribed, make sure you are. Larry's Substack, he wrote, with the sharp drop in U.S. equities investors have experienced and the questions I've been getting about the drop, I thought I would update a piece I wrote back in 2008 explaining why bear markets are a necessary evil. Larry, take it away.
Yeah, so we could define a necessary evil as something that maybe isn't pleasant, but is needed. And the most common thing I think people can relate to are taxes. You want to live in a country and have police and schools and, you know, Social Security and Medicare in the U.S.? Well, we got to pay taxes to support that as well as defense. So that's a good example of a necessary evil. And I wrote it that way because bear markets really are a necessary evil, or investors should think about it that way, because if stocks didn't experience the kind of bear markets that we have, investors would actually be very unhappy. So let's think about why that's the case. The most common, most important, the most basic principle of finance is the relationship between risk and expected, but not, of course, guaranteed return, right? So the more risk, the higher the expected return, which means if risk is high, which means that there have been risk of big losses, then investors apply a bigger risk premium, which leads to the denominator in the formula of a net present value. The numerator is the expected earnings. The denominator is the risk-free rate plus the risk premium. Well, the bigger the losses have been historically, then that people would think of equities as being more risky. So I point out in my article that the U.S. has experienced, you know, four periods where the losses were greater than the 34% that we experienced in the U.S. during the COVID crisis, which lasted just a month and 4 days from February 19th to March 23rd. From January 29th through December 32, the market lost 64%. From January 73 through September 74, it lost 43%. From April 2000 through September 2002, it lost 44%. And from November 2007 through February 2009, it lost 51%. Now, imagine for the moment that U.S. equities, the worst loss that ever had experienced was 10%. Clearly, investors would view equities as a lot less risky than it was. Even in the post-war period, we've experienced nothing like the Great Depression. And so that's one of the reasons that the equity risk premium has come down. People are willing to pay more because they believe the Federal Reserve has learned from the mistakes of the 1930s when it tightened monetary policy in the middle of a Great Depression. We now have much better accounting regulations. We have an SEC, which we didn't have before. And we have much better regulatory rules guiding the actions of corporate executives, much more severe penalties for breaking the law. So there's investors believe it's safer. So if you go back to the 1970s or so, the average PE may have been just 15. So maybe it gets to the 20 in a good period and goes much lower in a bad period. For the last 25 years in the U.S., the average PE has been over 20. And so people believing markets are less risky because the economic cycle risk has gone down. We haven't had a really severe recession except for 2008 in the last, 40 years. So think about it. If the worst recession caused the market to only drop 10%, maybe investors would be willing to pay 30 times earnings instead of 20 times earnings. That would mean the discount rate would go down, the net present value would go up, so the price of equities would be higher. You don't change the earnings of those companies, just the discount rate. And therefore, instead of stocks returning, say, 10% historically, maybe they would have returned 5%. And what if the worst loss had only been 5%? Well, maybe the price would have, PE would go to 40 on average. Right? So the point being that bear markets really are necessities to create the large equity risk premium that has been called the equity risk premium puzzle. Why have stock returns been so high when corporate earnings are nowhere near as volatile as stock prices? And the reason is investors hate big losses. They don't like the risk that that creates, and therefore they demand the big risk premium. So the right way to think about bear markets is they're really good, especially when you're young and accumulating assets. And as long as you don't get fired from your job, you get to buy at much lower prices and get higher expected returns. They're bad when you're retired because you're withdrawing from your portfolio and you can't recover money that's already been spent. Those assets are gone. Okay. So the right way to think about bear markets is they are a necessary evil in order to create the large equity risk premium we have enjoyed for the last 100 years. Okay. And therefore, you have to make sure you don't take more risk than, as we've discussed many times, you have the ability, willingness, or need to take risk. And as you age, your ability and willingness to take risk is probably going down. And therefore, you should be lowering your exposure to that economic cycle risk. And if you're young and you have a stable job, well, then you could take that risk. But if you're in an industry that is highly correlated with economic cycle risk, say home building, construction, autos, et cetera, then maybe you should have a little lower equity allocation or certainly a reserve of a significant number of maybe years, two or three at least, that you wouldn't be forced to sell equities at a time when they're in distress. And that's actually the time you want to be a buyer when everyone else is panic selling because expected returns are now highest.
Yeah. In fact, while you were speaking, I went on to Shiller's website to download his data and look at that. And I just, went back to 1900 and made this chart. But here you can see, and of course, it gets a little meaningless when you look backwards because the numbers were so small. Maybe if I put on a logarithmic scale, it would have a different meaning. But the point is, here we can see in 2000, the dot-com bubble crashed, and then we can see the 2008 bubble crashed, and then we saw the COVID crash, and now we're seeing a recent crash. So bear markets ultimately, as you say, are a necessary evil.
Yeah, they restore a larger equity risk premium. The worst thing that happened to young investors was the bull market we really experienced from 2009 through 2024, because that drove the PE ratios way up and expected returns down just when you're investing. It was the best thing that happened to retirees because their assets continued to grow. And as they withdrew, they weren't suffering because those assets kept appreciating. So you really have to consider the stage you're in as well when you think about your asset allocation.
And although the economy and the stock market don't correlate, it is interesting to think about the bubble and the boom and the bust. I know Peter Schiff I listened to him recently, and he said something that maybe came from someone else, but the point is that the recession is the cure. Huh. And what his point was, and I think it's very true, is that when good times are here, all kinds of people enter every industry until eventually very high returns get competed away. And then you have oversupply. And then you have the peak of an economic bubble. And then eventually what happens is the weak players get knocked out. And I would argue the reason why we haven't had a sustained recession for a long time is because the COVID period was like a flash recession that just instantly knocked out maybe 500,000 businesses in America and maybe 10 million businesses around the world. Boom. The weakest ones that may have had to die slowly were put to death. How do we think about the economy and the cycles in the economy versus the cycles in the bear markets in the market?
Well, you have to be careful about your comment that the economy and the stock market aren't correlated. I think you would find that they are with a lag because the stock market is forward-looking. So it tends to go down before we get a recession, and it tends to recover when we get a recession, right? Maybe in the middle of it, because the market looks ahead and says, gee, the government is likely to enact fiscal stimulatory policies that'll help recovery. The Federal Reserve is going to lower interest rates and ease monetary policy, and that will stimulate the economy. So the market actually tends to go up once we get through the early stages, possibly, of a recession. It tends to go down ahead of the recession because it's anticipating it. And anticipating, for example, that there are excesses in the Federal Reserve, it's going to have to tighten monetary policy, et cetera. In this case, what we're seeing, just to discuss what's going on now, the market concerned about the uncertainty by a self-imposed recession because of the uncertainty of the Trump's war on trade policy. In the other cases, all of the other instances were exogenous events. So we had the events of 73-4, we had an oil embargo. We had 2001, we had the terrorist attack. 2008, we had a global financial crisis. 2020, we had COVID. This is a policy-induced one, which leads me to believe if rational people, and I don't know how rational President Trump is, everyone will have to make their own decisions, if the markets start to crash, that alone can induce a recession because of the wealth effect. All the uncertainty he's created has driven consumer confidence way down. That means they're likely to spend less. We don't see it right away. In fact, we're seeing the reverse because people spent more in the fourth quarter, in the first quarter, to buy things before tariffs went into effect. And so they front-loaded things. So the next quarters could be weak. Corporate executives, their confidence level is way down. So CapEx is down. No one's going to build a plant in the U.S. because they don't know if the tariffs will be there or not. So until they know, right? And the wealth effect with the market going down is another problem because people will spend less. And all the Doge cuts, it's not just the jobs lost there, which is probably a very good thing, get rid of bloated government. But there are probably 2 to 3 jobs in the private sector supporting every single job in the government sector. Just think about the hotels and the restaurants and the airfares and, you know, the cell phones that, you know, and all that stuff and the consultants and everything else. So you're talking about hundreds of thousands of jobs. You're just seeing a bunch of the consulting firms, you know, well-known firms have already agreed to slash billions of dollars, right? That's got to slow the economy to some degree. Now, it may also help the budget deficits, which in the long term would be a positive.
So in theory, the stock market is telling us we're in for, potentially in for a weaker economy.
Well, the market is more uncertain, so the risk premium goes up. Whether we get the recession or not depends upon, you know, sort of read the tea leaves, and you can make your own judgment about this. My assumption is as follows. But I have to admit, I'm always humble, as you know, about making forecasts. I always tell people my crystal ball is cloudy. I don't change my investment policies, strategies based on them, because I know I can't forecast any better than anyone else. And I tell people, despite how much you want to believe that there's somebody out there who can predict the future, there's only one person who knows what will happen, and you and I will never get to talk to him or her while we're on this planet. Therefore, ignore forecasts. But here's what I think is likely, or at least, you know, better than a 50-50 chance. I believe that the president watches the stock market as a gauge of his performance. And he knows he's got a big election coming up, not that far in the future. And if you get a recession come the third or fourth quarters, that's going to run right into the election, the primaries and everything else. He's got such a thin majority, he cannot risk it. So what he's likely to do is the following, I believe, announce very quickly major agreements on basic tariff trade policy. He can't announce deals because it takes historically 9 to 18 months to negotiate very complex deals, which have much more to do than just tariffs, but regulatory rules, safety rules, and all kinds of barriers governments throw up to protect domestic industries. But he could announce India and the U.S. or Taiwan and the U.S. have announced a general agreement that we're going to go to zero tariffs on manufactured goods, and we're going to work on these five other things. And Taiwan has agreed to invest $1 trillion in U.S. manufacturing. And then when you get one deal, a lot of other people will rush because they will want to not be excluded. And that'll set the stage. Then the market will think ahead and we will avoid the recession. If I'm wrong and Trump doesn't use the common sense that he should have and this drags on, then you could see a recession, which means earnings in the average recession go down about 10%. And PEs could easily drop from 20 to 15. So you would get an earnings maybe of $230 or something like that for the S&P and put a just a 15 PE. That's not a bear market even. Mm-hmm. And you're about 4,000 on the S&P. So I don't rule out at all a drop that could be another 20% from here or so. So a portfolio has to be able to withstand both the good and the bad outcomes, because we don't know which outcome is likely.
I had a couple of questions in the chapter. These are kind of, let's say, quick ones, but you mentioned one thing where you said from 1926 through 2022, the S&P has provided an annual compound risk premium over 1 month treasury bills of 8.2% and an annualized premium of 6.9%. So let's say equity risk premium about 7%.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's because, by the way, the average PE over the 100 years was about 17, 16, 17. Invert that, and guess what? You got an earnings yield of 6 to 7, which equates to about what the real return to stocks were. Andrew, you put up the current Cape 10. You want to show people what that is? And then we can invert that for them. It's come down some because the market has dropped, you know, close to 20%. And it's rebounded a bit the last couple of days.
Yep.
I think peak to trough was down 20%. The current forward estimate of earnings, which I think the earnings estimates are likely too high, especially if we get a recession, is about 20. So that would be an earnings yield of 5%. So that would tell you the expected real return to stocks is 5% now, not 7. But you still have a wide dispersion of possible outcomes around that. The Cape 10 is not a good predictor of returns in the next 1, 2, 3 years. It's a reasonably good one over the longer term, like 10 years.
Right.
It's about as good as we have.
Okay. So let me pull that up 1 second. So what we're seeing for the people that are listening, we're seeing the P.E. ratio.
It looks like about 33 there, maybe.
Yeah. So let's just say the recent peak was about 37, let's say, and it's come down to about 33.
So 33 would be a 3% real return. You know, that's, I don't know how many people would take the risk of investing in stocks for a 3% real return when you can buy tips guaranteeing a 2% or so real return.
Right. And let's just look at that from a, let's say, just a long-term average, which we can see here.
Yeah, I'd be careful. The long-term average is about 17 now, but that's misleading because of the reasons I mentioned earlier. Mm. In much of that period, there was no Federal Reserve. There was no SEC. We didn't have GAAP accounting rules. We didn't have Sarbanes-Oxley. All of these things, which made equities less risky. So I think, you know, a more normal number might be the last 40 or 50 years, maybe, or last 25. And now you're looking at a Cape 10 much lower. So I think, you know, still, obviously, 33 would be way above, say, 20 or so. So we're still way above that. The current P is much more in line with the last 25 years or even a bit longer.
So let's take the period of 1980, maybe.
Yeah, that's a reasonable one.
You could say that with 1980, we definitely had the Fed, you know, being a much more active player.
Right.
So now let's look at that chart again, and we can see even if we did that, that's going to shift it up from about 17 times to about, what do we say, 23 times.
Right.
But still, yes, we're way above it. Not as above as we were in the dot-com bubble. And one of the things about the dot-com boom or bubble was that we had a huge, you know, very small earnings and zero earnings for many of the largest tech companies. Whereas now those companies, even though they may suffer a bit, they're still super profitable.
That's why you're not seeing the Cape 10 at 45, you're seeing it 33.
If we look at,
you got to remember, if you get that recession, which would be a self-imposed one because of President Trump's, the uncertainties created, the earnings are going to come down. And then the risk premium will also go up. And that's how you get big bear markets. And so it wouldn't shock me. I'm not making that as a prediction at all. But it wouldn't shock me if we sat here in 6 months and the S&P was 4,200 because we had a recession induced by a failure to get trade deals done. And I would add there are other things that are certainly possible. You know, there is tremendous geopolitical risk around the world, certainly Russia and Ukraine, certainly Iran. We could see the U.S., if U.S. and Israel don't get Iran to agree to abandon nuclear weapons with a verifiable testing, I believe there's a 98% chance or more that Israel and the U.S., or even Israel on their own, will launch a strike to destroy their nuclear facility. Who knows what that could trigger? And Taiwan, given China's problems, if the U.S. persists in this trade war, China could decide their economy could get into a serious recession, and they could be concerned even about being overthrown politically. They want to distract their population and launch an attack on to try to take over Taiwan. I mean, I'm not predicting any of these things, but I don't think anyone could say the chances of those things happening are zero.
Yep. The last thing I want to ask you about what's in the chapter, it made me think about, when we talk about small cap, you know, we talk about small cap premium and small cap companies having a big loss relative to large cap companies and all that. I kind of realized that we need to differentiate when we listen to people talking about small caps performance. We need to differentiate between just small cap return relative to, let's say, the overall market or relative to large cap versus long, small cap, short, large cap premium, right? That we're talking about, the factor premium. How should we think about those two things and what generally it's been the difference. And can we really capture that long, short premium in small cap? Or should we be thinking about just the premium of, you know, small cap performance? How do we think about that?
Yeah, gee, we need a whole hour to get to that one, Andrew, but let's see if we can make it short. First of all, the small cap premium is really polluted, if you will, because of investor at the retail level behavior. Retail investors have a weird preference. It's not financially rational. It may be psychologically rational to buy the stocks of small cap growth companies with high levels of investment and low profitability. They're hoping to hit the lottery, if you will, and find the next Microsoft. It turns out that stocks with those characteristics have underperformed treasury bills over the long term. Cliff Asness and the team at AQR wrote a paper saving, I forgot the exact name, but it's saving the size premium by getting rid of junk. And once you do that, the size premium all of a sudden is restored. We haven't seen a size premium basically since it was written about in the 1980s by Ralph Bands. And it's polluted. Once you look at small companies that are more profitable, low, they're value stocks that are profitable, then there is a size premium. But you have to get rid of the junk stocks. Another example are stocks in bankruptcy. They have penny stocks. You know, take a guess what percentage of these stocks, even though they trade, they are still in indices, you know, and stuff. So an index fund that's pure replicating would buy it. So a stock like Hertz that declares bankruptcy, let's say, it's traded. Take a guess what percentage of them ever return one penny to shareholders. Is it 50%, 80%, 20%?
Yeah, I would say 40% return and 60%.
You're 40 times too high. It's 1%.
1%.
And yet people love this, right? Okay. So when you look at the small cap premium, people say there's no small cap premium. It's because you have this junk. And once you get rid of that, the small cap premium is restored. And it's been something on the order of 2.5% per annum. And then you get a profitability premium on top of that if you stick with the, you know, those companies in general, or is that size profitability premium. So it's very hard to capture it long short, because the worst performance, guess what, is in the short side. So you have to go short, and it's very expensive to borrow those stocks, because the risk of going short, like with Hertz, it went way up, or GameStop, you know, you can get squeezed by these crazy people at Reddit who want to go after hedge funds and stuff. And so that's what's called limits to arbitrage that allow these stocks to persist as overvalued. The way to access the premium, if you will, is to buy small cap stocks that are higher in quality, profitable, and cheap, and go long them. And over the long term, you should have higher expected returns, you know, because they are riskier, smaller, less liquid companies.
Right.
And you'll outperform the junk as well.
And just to show that, here's a chart I just made. This was something I did before, where I looked at a 10-year stock market moving average to smooth out the ups and downs and just to understand. But here you can see that the blue line is the small cap premium. That's the long, short
premium. Ended right around 83 when Ralph Bands published his paper.
Yep. And so we had a underperformance, then up, outperformance, then underperformance, which tells you it's pretty much been destroyed. And that,
You got to remember, much of this has occurred in the last 10 years when the price, which you have to analyze, Andrew, be very careful here. You have to ask, why did large caps outperform? Did they out-earn? Which in case you could say, all right, that should persist, the small cap premium is gone. Or did the PE ratios go way up? And much of that outperformance, perhaps all of it, is due to the spread widening. Small cap stocks are trading maybe 10 times earnings and large cap trading at 30. So you get an average market of 20. I'm just making an example. Yeah. And it's because the spreads have widened dramatically. That's certainly been the case in value stocks. And it's also been the case of U.S. stocks outperforming international until this year. 80% almost of U.S. outperformance over the last 17 years has been P.E. expansion, not earnings expansion. And much of the earnings expansion was due to interest expenses coming down when the Fed adapted a ZIRP policy.
That's gone away now. Yeah.
And as those refinances come due, maybe people borrow 10-year money back in 2018 or 19 and, you know, a few more years, then they'll have to pay again market rates.
Okay, so in wrapping up, let me just also mention that the paper you're talking about is called Size Matters, If You Control Your Junk.
Yeah, the latest it's a great version, paper.
Yeah, latest version came out in 2018. It's on SSRN. And as you said, Cliff. So, and just to read the abstract just briefly, the size premium has been challenged along many fronts. It has a weak historical record, very significantly over time, in particular weakening after its discovery in the early 80s. And it's concentrated among microcap stocks, predominantly resides in January, and is not present for measures of size that do not rely on market prices, is weak internationally, and is subsumed by proxies for illiquidity. We find, however, that these challenges are dismantled when controlling for the quality or the inverse of junk of a firm. Interesting. That's a great paper. Okay. I look forward to it. Well, let's wrap it up there. Larry, I want to thank you for this great discussion. And I'm looking forward to the next chapter. And the next chapter is chapter number 35, Mad Money. Now, I don't watch TV, but I hear there's a guy named Jim Cramer we're going to talk about. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, it's an interesting discussion. It amazes me, given he's been exposed, that he adds no value. He's been around for, I don't know, 30 years, and people still tune into his show when the academic research shows he knows nothing.
Well, he may not add any value in our stock market performance, but apparently he adds some kind of entertainment value.
Yeah, that he's certainly an entertainer if you like, you know, clowns.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're looking forward. That's going to be a fun one. So for listeners out there who want to keep up with all that Larry's doing, you can follow him on X at Larry Swedrow. You can follow him on LinkedIn. And maybe, Larry, you can tell us, what are you doing with Substack?
Yeah, so I decided now that I've left Buckingham, I'm semi-retired. I still do some consulting to now 8 firms part-time. So I still want to write and I have a lot more time to give back and help people learn about markets. So I write for 4 other websites, Wealth Management, Financial Advisor, Morningstar, and Alpha Architect. So you could follow me there or simply follow me on X, Twitter, or Substack. So I'm writing more than the others have the capacity to take. So I decided, all right, I could publish on Substack. It's free, you know, at least for now. And it allows me to add commentary like I added today about the bear markets are necessary evil, rather than writing. Most of my stuff is writing about the academic literature, reviewing what the researchers looked at, what they found, and the implications and takeaways for investors. This allows me to comment more on investor behavior and how they should be thinking about things in the marketplace. So I would urge all your listeners to check it out. And if you're interested, just subscribe and tell your friends, and hopefully that'll make you a better investor.
Fantastic. And the great thing about Substack is that you get a notification when a new piece comes out, where you may miss that on Twitter, you may miss that on LinkedIn. So that's great. Well, this is your worst podcast host, Andrew Stott, saying, I'll see you on the upside.